Hey humans,
want to optimize your cardiovascular health with real data? SciFox Health offers the easiest, most affordable blood biomarker testing kits. Test 17 key biomarkers like cholesterol, ApoB, and hemoglobin A1C from the comfort of your own home and get results at your fingertips in just a few days. Get 20% off at SciFoxHealth.com/Yami. Know your biomarkers and live healthier.
Rather than focus on being perfect, I think we need to look at how we can make the greatest difference around us in reducing suffering. And this doesn't even, this is going to surprise some people. This doesn't even mean that veganism is the end game, that being vegan is the end result. Reducing suffering is the end result. If we can reduce suffering for millions or hundreds of millions or billions of animals, even if those participating in the reduction of suffering are not totally vegan, that's a win. That should be celebrated, especially in a world where 99% of people are not vegan.
You are here for a reason, but navigating this human life can be challenging. How do you care for your body, mind, and spirit to make the most of your time here on Earth? How can you harness your incredible human potential? In this podcast, we explore these questions and more to help you craft your best life yet. Welcome to I Am Human.
Hi, humans. I am your host, Dr. Yami, and I am so happy to be here with you today. Thank you so much for tuning in and welcome. I would appreciate if you subscribe, rate, review, and share this episode. To be human means to focus on yourself and your own safety and survival, but it also means to be altruistic and to help others, and that includes non-human animals. Our guest today is very passionate and compassionate animal advocate, Robert Cheek. Robert grew up on a farm in Corvallis, Oregon, where he adopted a vegan lifestyle in 1995 at the age of 15, weighing just 120 pounds. Today, he is the author of the books, Vegan Bodybuilding and Fitness, Shredded, Plant-Based Muscle, and the New York Times bestseller, The Plant-Based Athlete. And now he has a new book out called The Impactful Vegan, which was released in June of 2024. He is often referred to as the godfather of vegan bodybuilding, growing the industry from infancy in 2002 to where it is today. As a natural bodybuilding champion, Robert is considered one of Veg News magazine's most influential vegan athletes. He tours around the world sharing his story of transformation from a skinny farm kid to champion vegan bodybuilder. Robert is the founder of Vegan Bodybuilding and Fitness and maintains the website veganbodybuilding.com. He is a regular contributor to Forks Over Knives, the Center for Nutrition Studies, Vegan Strong, The Vegan Gym, and No Meat Athlete. He is a former multi-sport athlete and has followed a plant-based diet for more than 28 years. Robert lives in Colorado with his wife and two rescued chihuahuas. And in today's episode, we talk about his vegan journey and why he became vegan at the age of 15. I ask him if there's such thing as a perfect vegan. He defines effective altruism. And we talk about how our personal biases can get in the way of doing the most good or being the most effective in our movement. We talk about how you can lead by example, and he gives us a list of organizations that can help us determine what the most effective way to allocate our time and resources is. It's a really great episode. Robert is very knowledgeable. He's very passionate. He has so much experience, and I am so glad he's written this book to help guide us so that we can also practice effective altruism. Thank you once again for listening to this episode. I hope that you have a very fantastic day. And now let us welcome Robert Cheek.
The information on this podcast is for informational and educational purposes only. It is not meant to replace careful evaluation and treatment. If you have concerns about your health or well-being, please consult a healthcare professional.
Robert Cheek, welcome to I Am Human. What a pleasure to have you on the show today.
Thank you, Dr. Yami. I appreciate it. Appreciate the opportunity.
Well, thank you for writing such a wonderful book. I read it this weekend. It's fabulous. And I'm so excited to talk to you about your latest book. But first, since I haven't had you on the show before, I know many of my listeners are familiar with you and your work, but I'd love to know a little bit about your origin story. Why did you become vegan at the age of 15?
Yeah, I like to say I've been vegan since the late 1900s. It gives me a little bit of that. It's 100% accurate, and it gives me that just a level of experience. The white in my beard does the same, but yeah, I've been vegan since the late 1900s, since before this thing called the internet that we had at home. And that came about because I grew up on a farm and I raised animals. I raised animals that trusted me as their friend, as their best friend in some cases. And then I broke that trust by selling those animals at an auction to be turned into someone else's meal. And, you know, that didn't sit well with me. And my older sister became vegan before I did. And she organized this animal rights week at my high school. And so she brought in speakers and played, you know, videos and passed out literature and had, you know, kind of like a vegan bake sale, so to speak, baked goods and all that. And I decided to participate for a week. That was all I was going to give it. I was going to, out of respect for my older sister, I was going to be vegan for a week. And that started on December 8th, 1995. And it has continued on to today. And basically, why did that continue on? Well, it's because I started to look at animals differently. Even though I grew up on a small farm, we lived right next to a dairy and there was another dairy farm down the road. But we had a relatively small farm, mostly just raising animals for 4-H and for fun and, you know, and to have animal companions and all of that. But once I got more familiar with large scale industrialized factory farming and large scale animal testing and large scale animal suffering, I decided I wanted to do my part to stand against that, make a stand against that and live a compassionate vegan lifestyle. And so that's what I did. But I was 15 years old. I was a 5-sport athlete. I was concerned about how I would get enough protein or how I would build my body. I was always a small kid. I weighed 89.25 pounds in 8th grade before going into high school. I barely weighed 100 pounds when I got into high school. And as a sophomore, when I became vegan, I was about 120 pounds. I had no idea that I would add another 100 pounds and become a 220-pound champion vegan bodybuilder and write a bunch of books on the subject and tour to 5 continents around the world over the past 20 years, talking about building my body from a skinny farm kid to champion vegan bodybuilder. But here we are.
100 pounds of plants. Yeah. That's a lot of plants.
I joke that it's not exactly the American dream, you know, to add 100 pounds, but I did it and I did it with plants. And I had no business in the sport of bodybuilding. It was laughable when I first started lifting little weights. But I just kept telling myself and telling others, you know, just wait, you know, a year from now or 3 years from now or 5 years from now. I actually predicted in a really weird way. I manifested or predicted or whatever you want to say that I would be on magazine covers, that I would become a New York Times bestselling author, that I would do these different things, become a champion bodybuilder, even though I didn't know anything about the sport. And I did all of those things and a bunch of others. And you know, I think there were certain principles that I followed that enabled that and a certain work ethic and drive. And obviously a lot of people who paved a path before me and a lot of privileges that I have and that I inherited. And I am grateful for those. And I feel a responsibility to do the best that I can to improve the lives of others, including farmed animals. And so that's what I've set out to do for the last 30 years or so.
That's amazing. I mean, what a journey. And I'll just say, putting on 100 pounds and obviously mostly muscle, we'll say all muscle, okay? Say you put on 100 pounds of muscle. I mean, that's incredible. It takes so much dedication, no matter what you're eating, because there's people who are eating omnivorous and they think like, okay, if I just eat a bunch of protein from animals, this is going to help me get big. But even that, like you still have to be very dedicated. You have to have a plan. You have to be in the gym frequently. You can't just eat a bunch of quote protein and think that you're just going to put on that muscle. So, I mean, that really took a lot of work on your part.
Well, it took a lot of work, but it also was difficult when I was one of the only people in the world doing it before the internet, or when the internet was brand new and most of us didn't have computers at home, or we were still learning how to use this World Wide Web and there weren't a lot of books on it. There were a few books on veganism, of course, but this is before documentaries, before YouTube, before all those things. And so I kind of had to figure things out on my own or with some other vegan bodybuilding colleagues and just kind of carve our own path. And I would say that was probably the most difficult part, was that there wasn't really a blueprint. There wasn't a system to follow. I had to really carve that out and create it myself. And that's why I filmed a documentary about it in 2005 and wrote a book on it in 2010 and many books since, because it was something that I had to learn along the way and practice different approaches and see what works, see what sticks. And you're right that it does take a level of dedication in the gym, or just showing up time and time and time again. I mean, even now, I'm in my mid-40s. I've been training for decades. I've got some of the lower back soreness that a lot of us do who have been lifting weights for a very long time, for a quarter of a century or more. And I've still been in the gym 6 days a week for the past few weeks. You know, I'm still doing my thing and still maintaining, you know, 200-pound frame as a vegan athlete, still lifting heavy weights well into my mid-40s. And, you know, I will probably be able to maintain that for quite some time with the type of plant-based nutrition that I've learned over the decades and with the things that I've learned about training and consistency and compounding and all of those things that matter in the long run, rest and recovery and reducing inflammation and eating the right kinds of foods and the right mindset and all of that. And those have all served me very, very well. And I certainly wouldn't have been able to do really any of these things without having mentors like my older sister, like great coaches, like friends that hold me accountable, training partners and fellow athletes that I could learn from and train with, and even chiropractors and doctors that, you know, helped along the way when you do face those injuries from this type of sport that is involved in resistance weight training, and injuries happen. So all of those things combined, as well as the support of the vegan community and the fitness community, have enabled me to do these things, which has been very fulfilling and very rewarding, and has led me to, right now, the author of The Impactful Vegan, feeling like I do live a very impactful vegan lifestyle because I use those experiences and I use fitness as a vehicle and plant-based nutrition as an entry point to bring people into the lifestyle to live more compassionately and live a more cruelty-free lifestyle, and which is what I really set out to do back in those late 1900s.
Wow, it's incredible. Well, we're very grateful to you for having the courage and having the persistence and dedication to figuring it out and then teaching the rest of us, you know, carving that path, paving the pathway for the rest of us to follow. So we're grateful for that. Is there such a thing as a perfect vegan?
I don't think there is such a thing as a perfect vegan. Veganism is a philosophy to strive for. It's defined as living a lifestyle that is free of contributing to unnecessary animal suffering whenever possible and practicable. But that's not always possible and practicable. If we drive a vehicle, if we walk on streets with ants and bugs and other insects, clearly we're contributing to some sort of suffering. If we eat anything at all plants are harvested on large scale machinery that does, unfortunately, take the lives of some of those animals that are out there in the fields. So there's no perfectionism within veganism, just like there's no perfectionism within mentoring or yoga. It's a practice. And I think we have to not get hung up on that trying to be the perfect vegan. I know I did. I would refuse to sit in cars with leather seats, even if I was just a passenger in a friend's vehicle or a rental car or something like that. If somebody at a sandwich shop was making my totally plant-based sandwich, but they had touched meat with their fingers or their gloves before making my sandwich, I wouldn't eat it. I did a lot of different practices that did not actually reduce animal suffering at all. It didn't make a difference. Slight cross-contamination is another example. We tend to be grossed out by it. That's ego. That's personal ego. Like, I don't want to touch that. I want nothing to do with that. If the fries were cooked in the same oil as the chicken or whatever, but it doesn't contribute to any additional unnecessary animal suffering. It just is kind of gross or is something that we're turned off by. But in doing so, in me saying, hey, I'm not going to sit in that car, or I'm not going to eat that sandwich someone just prepared for me because their gloves touched some meat, or you know what, there's a tiny sliver of cheese in that otherwise totally plant-based taco or burrito. I'm not going to eat it. I'm not going to touch it. I'm going to give it away or throw it away. This does nothing to bring people into veganism or to normalize veganism or to show that it's practical and that it's socially acceptable or that it's easy to do or that it can be even be considered a normal activity. And so I think when we focus on perfection, we sometimes turn a lot of people away from more compassionate choices they could make if we just embrace the fact that we're all imperfect. We're all imperfect beings striving to basically be able to justify our actions to sleep at night. I mean, it's this whole cognitive dissonance thing. And no matter what we do, we're just trying to feel better when we go to sleep at night, like that I'm living in, call it whatever you want. I'm living in alignment with my purpose, or I'm living in alignment with compassion, or I'm trying to be authentic, or I'm trying to make a difference in the world, whatever it is. Or I'm simply trying to justify the entire vegan cake I ate last night. We will find a way to justify it so we can feel good about ourselves. But I think we need to, rather than focus on being perfect, I think we need to look at how we can make the greatest difference around us in reducing suffering. And this doesn't even, this is going to surprise some people. This doesn't even mean that veganism is the end game, that being vegan is the end result. Reducing suffering is the end result. If we can reduce suffering for millions or hundreds of millions or billions of animals, even if those participating in the reduction of suffering are not totally vegan, that's a win. That should be celebrated, especially in a world where 99% of people are not vegan. If you do the actual numbers, sometimes people throw around, oh, we're 3% of the population. No, that's within one particular country, perhaps. But globally, we're less than 1%. That can either be very discouraging, or it can be motivating that we've got a lot of work to do. We've got some tried and true systems of operation that work, that we've seen in various parts of the world where reduction of animal suffering is much more successful than it is in other parts of the world. We can model those systems and we can help achieve what the UK and Germany are experiencing right now, which is the lowest levels of meat production or consumption in, you know, recorded history. And we can learn from those practices and spread the word in a positive way. So I have entire sections in the book about not sweating the small stuff, and don't try to be perfect. Try to make the biggest impact that you can, and that's where you're going to make a difference.
Yeah, I mean, that applies to so much in life, doesn't it? How perfectionism can get in the way of our actual goals and take energy away from what we could be doing. So maybe this is a great time for you to define effective altruism.
Yeah, absolutely. So effective altruism is about doing the most good with the resources that we have. That's the simple version. There's the beautiful definition that William McCaskill came up with. He's the co-founder of the effective altruism movement, which came about around 2012 or so. And it's about, you know, using like data-driven evidence and using science to have an impartial approach to discovering whatever the most impactful thing is, and then to do whatever that turns out to be. It's more eloquent, and the quote is in my book. I don't have the page pulled up to read it, but basically, ultimately, effective altruism is doing the most good, not doing some good, not doing a little bit of good, but how do we actually maximize our impact? And there's plenty of examples. I can give you a couple. This first came on my radar from Peter Singer's book, The Most Good You Can Do. And then that led me to William McCaskill's book, Doing Good Better. And then Nick Cooney's good book, How to Be Great at Doing Good. All very similar titles about doing good. And for example, if you're contributing to reducing suffering around the world in one particular area, let's say blindness, it takes about $50,000, $50,000 to train a seeing eye dog to help one person for, I don't know, 8 or 10 years, the duration of the dog's life as a professional seeing eye dog. But there's common eye disease throughout parts of the world, India, Bangladesh, Nepal, just happens to be very, very common, which leads to blindness. And that can be totally prevented through surgery for about $200, $200. So you can prevent blindness for, what's the math on that? I don't know, thousands of people for the next 50 years of their life for the same amount of money that it takes to help one person with that one seen eye dog. Similarly, we could donate X amount of resources to help people in the developed world with, I don't know, let's even say something that's very close to home on the minds of many, let's say hunger. Or for a certain amount of money, we could impact a certain number of people in the developed world, or we could provide anti-malaria bed nets to those in sub-Saharan Africa in a life or death situation, contracting malaria from mosquito bites and all of that, for a fraction of the price of helping save and spare the lives of exponentially more people. And you can go down the line. There's all kinds of examples. What's better, to contribute, again, either some sort of financial donation or contribution to museum or the arts or theater that only impacts affluent people, or to help donate and prevent diarrhea in parts of the world where a million people or half a million people are going to die every year from that disease? It's very easy to see that doing one action can be 5, 10, 100, or even 1,000 times more effective than another action in the form of contribution, of donation, of allocating funds, and all of that. So effective altruism looks at primarily how to most effectively eradicate or reduce human poverty. And so a lot of it is targeted on, very naturally, the biggest causes of death among the very poorest people in the world. People who, in many cases, and I've heard even personal stories about this, and of course read about it, there are many people around the world that have no concept of soap. It's never been introduced to their life. They don't know how to use soap or what it's meant for or what it's supposed to do. This is important stuff in preventing the suffering of large numbers of people. There are parts of the world where birth control is not available and not accessible and not very widely known and all of that. There's lots of things that we can focus on. And there's even a way of measuring, it sounds kind of weird and even hard to think about, but there's a way of even measuring suffering called the QALY score, quality adjusted life years, on a scale of 1 to 10. I mean, what's worse? Does suffer from migraines every single day of your life, or have chronic diarrhea, or have lost 2 or 3 limbs, or to have some other almost like a poison oak type itch that never goes away? Or, I mean, you can go down the list and list all these things. And there's actually a way to determine, based on feedback from those who have suffered from these things, and say, yeah, my quality of life, you know, went from a 10 to a 4 when I had this, or when I suffer from this. Someone else will say, with their other unfortunate issue, perhaps, my quality of life is a 5 or a 6. And you survey enough people, you can determine, okay, this thing is worse than this. And therefore, if we can help prevent this deeper level of suffering, we could, especially if it affects large numbers of people, we can allocate time, resources, energy, donations, volunteering, generosity to help with that. And so what I did, having read multiple books and listening to countless philosophy podcasts and conversations on the subject, I thought, you know what? There's a lot going on here to reduce human poverty in really effective ways. Like understanding the most effective and impactful charity organizations in the world, the parts of the world that are most neglected, the people that are suffering in the greatest amount and why, and how we can help them. And I thought, you know what? I want to take that approach, those principles of effective altruism, and apply them to animals, and in particular to farmed animals, because people care about dogs and cats and horses and birds to some degree. But on a large scale, nobody cares about chickens. Nobody cares about cows and goats and sheep and ducks and geese and turkeys on a just a statistical scale. And so those are all individuals who have their own interests and their own desires to live a life free of fear, pain, and suffering. I know. I spent over 20 years on a farm. I raised chickens. I raised cows. I raised goats, turkeys, geese, rabbits, ducks. I was able to experience that firsthand, that these individuals have their own desires and their own families and their own personalities. And just because they're not these domesticated animals that we love, like dogs, doesn't mean that they deserve to be bred into existence only to suffer for their entire lives and then to be slaughtered at a very young age. They're all adolescents. They're all babies, essentially. Everything from turkeys we have on Thanksgiving to chickens, they're all a number of weeks old, weeks or months old. And I realized and recognized that suffering is suffering, regardless of species, regardless of geographical location, and that I wanted to do something about it. And so I spent years writing this book, The Impactful Vegan. I spent years interviewing 30 or 40 of the world's leaders in veganism and in animal rights and historical context within those communities, people who have been doing this for decades, people who are the presidents of $50 million nonprofits who are changing the future of food, people who are the founders of nonprofit organizations like Farm Sanctuary or the presidents of the Humane League, or people who are the founders or presidents of for-profit companies that are displacing animal-based foods and replacing them with plants in grocery stores and restaurants across America. And I wanted to uncover very much what effective altruism is trying to do. They're trying to take the scientific method and follow it regardless of what the result is. And so I had my own preconceived ideas about what being an impactful vegan means. I had used fitness as a vehicle for that quite effectively for many years, for decades, in fact, because one of the biggest objections to veganism or a plant-based diet is a concern about protein intake and being able to build muscle. I had done that rather enthusiastically as a champion vegan bodybuilder who put on 100 pounds. I used that as an effective tool to meet people where they are with their concerns about dietary protein and nutrition on a plant-based diet. So I had some preconceived ideas and everything, what works, what types of advocacy are maybe not so effective. Like, I think we can all agree that, you know, just throwing, you know, red paint on someone that looks like, it looks like you're throwing blood on someone wearing a fur jacket, that's not going to, you know, that's not going to be super effective in bringing people to the cause and maybe grabbing a megaphone and yelling on the street and arguing with people and questioning their judgment or their character or name calling and all this stuff is probably not in the most effective way. But I wanted to find out. And so that's what I did. I looked at what the research says. I looked at what the survey data says. I looked at what actually makes a difference for animals. And I dedicated in chapters and entire sections of the book to understanding even which organizations do the most good, spare the most animal lives per dollar spent, and what actions you and I can take on a daily basis to make the biggest impact. And that's what I set out to do. And I was surprised by some of the answers, but that's what a scientific approach compels us to do, is to you follow what the evidence suggests, and that's how you make the biggest impact. And so that's what I'm doing.
So it's a way of looking at something objectively, rather than just by what feels good, which is what you talked about in the books. A lot of times we choose to do what feels good or what gives us that warm, fuzzy feeling. But at the end of the day, if it was a donation or if it was a dedication of our time, that could have been spent in a way that produced more good, that reduced more suffering if we knew the data. So tell me, how can our personal biases get in the way of doing the most good or being the most effective?
It's probably the most common thing that gets in the way is our personal biases, because I'm willing to bet that almost everybody listening has a personal bias toward their city, their state, their country, their continent. I mean, look, the Olympic Games are starting, I don't know when this airs, but the Olympic Games are starting any moment now. Most people, probably 99%, are going to be cheering for their country, their, you know, their favorite sport, their personal bias, even though they had nothing to do with where they were born or anything like that. Nothing, you know, it's nothing wrong with being, you know, proud of where you come from or anything. But we're so quick to say, I care about dogs first. And who cares about chickens or cows? They're just, you know, they're useless. Or I'm going to help support animals in my community, even if it costs me 20 times as much as helping animals in India or Thailand or Pakistan or in Kenya or Nigeria. I don't care. I have a bias towards the animals that I know and I see every day, the ones that I visit at the shelter, the ones that I see down the street or in my community. And that's where I tell people we need to pause for a moment Because if we want to be objective and truly make the biggest impact on reducing suffering throughout the world, we have to recognize the strength of the US dollar and how far that can go throughout the world. We have to recognize areas that are neglected and how we can make a difference there, how we can transform the lives of individuals who are suffering to the greatest degree. And that is going to challenge a lot of our preferences and our biases towards our favorite animals, our favorite forms of activism and advocacy, what we prefer, rather than looking at what's maybe not quite as sexy or that's not as fun, you know, not as fun as like making videos for the internet and getting lots of likes or whatever, but doing this work that makes the biggest difference, which sometimes is writing letters to the editor, writing articles for mainstream media, doing this work behind the scenes, fundraising, getting policies passed and legislation passed that can affect large swaths of animals all at once, like California Proposition 12, for example, that has positively impacted billions of animals. That's where we separate what we, you know, what we think is best and what is actually best. And I give lots of examples when I give my presentations throughout North America, as I've been on a speaking tour for months now with this new book, basically from January until now, almost nonstop. I hit the road again tomorrow. I feel like I'm going somewhere all the time. And I tell this story, maybe this will resonate with some listeners. It's just one that I kind of made up, but it was inspired by a book that I read, that if you're walking down the street, let's say you're on your way to dinner to meet with a friend, you're kind of walking quickly. And so you're not, you know, paying really close attention. You reach into your pocket to grab your phone, maybe to check something, and you accidentally knock $100 out of your pocket. And you get to your destination and it's not there anymore. And where'd that money go? You're frustrated. You're kind of upset with yourself a little bit. You're being careless and all that. But aside from that evening's plans, perhaps, how much does that change your entire world? Probably not that much. But for the poorest people in the entire world, who make the example in Doing Good Better was a poor Indian farmer who makes between $200 and $300 US dollars for the entire year. What would that $100 do for that poor farmer? I mean, that's half a year's income. It's profoundly different than the comforts we have in the Western world, where we have food and shelter and clothing and unlimited access to calories, to the point that we consume, on average, the average adult American now consumes 3,540 calories per day. Yet, I have two different friends who went to two different countries in Africa just recently, who both told me the exact same thing when I talked with them. One was in person, one was over Zoom. They both just shared this information that they met people who have to walk about 6 hours, or 6 miles one way to get clean water. You know, 6 miles one way, 6 miles back. Another friend I talked to, that was in Tanzania. I talked to a friend who just went to Kenya, and he said he met people who eat once a week or maybe twice a month. That's the only time they get to eat. And it's a reminder that we live in a very privileged society with a lot of excess, a lot of freedoms, a lot of comforts, a lot of luxuries, a lot of power, a lot of dominion, a lot of access to choice. And if we can pause for a moment and recognize the power that we have and look at the organizations that I highlight, like the Humane League, that can spare a chicken's life for as little as 33 cents, can we come to a conclusion, at least every once in a while, that maybe I don't need that new shirt that was probably made in some sort of sweatshop factory overseas anyway? Or do I need that latest electronic? Or do I need that expensive drink, or what I call unnecessary beverages? Do I need to, you know, water is free. We're lucky that it's free and that it's clean, that it's accessible and it's available to us. Do I need these unnecessary beverages when there are those who don't even have access to it? When there are 1 billion people, almost 1 billion, 800 million to a billion, who are going to bed hungry tonight, who don't know where their next meal is coming from, don't know when they're going to eat. And to recognize that the same struggle that a billion people have is a similar struggle that tens of billions of animals have, and that they endure every day of their lives, And they're different. They're different from us, but they share so many similar things, so many similar values, especially the value of their own life. And the fact that you know this, you teach this, I know this, that we can live perfectly healthy lives on a plant-based diet free of all animal protein, all animal food sources. And in fact, that could be better clearly for the animals, could be better for the environment, could be better for our future, could be better for land use and water use and clean air and for future generations. I don't have to tell you or even your audience that we have a problem with food in the Western world. I already told you we have 3,540 calories we consume per day on average per person. We have 73.6% of Americans who are overweight, 42.5% of Americans who are obese. And that's not to body shame anyone. That's to sound the alarm that when we eat a diet, I don't have the numbers exactly memorized, but it's something like 55% of our calories are processed junk food, another 30% or so are animal protein, and just a few percentage points for all grains, legumes, nuts, seeds, fruits, and vegetables combined. And the fact that this leads to common degenerative diseases, and it means that tens of billions of animals are factory farmed so we can nourish ourselves with those preferred taste preferences that have been cultivated throughout our lives ever since the first time we tried a chicken nugget or had pizza or had a burger. And just to recognize that it's clearly not working. It's not working for our society. It's not working for our health. It's not working for the environment. It's not working for animals. And there's a better way. And there are people doing it by the tens of millions of people who are vegan, who have vegan families, vegan children, vegan pets. This is practical. This is possible. And that's what I'm trying to show in The Impactful Vegan, all the different ways that we can address what the issue is, overcome it, provide solutions, and move forward and inspire others and put our resources in the right place to make the biggest impact we can.
September 29th is World Heart Day to raise awareness of the number one global cause of death, cardiovascular disease. We know that two critical risk factors for the development of cardiovascular disease are high cholesterol and diabetes. But so many people are living with high cholesterol and elevated blood sugars without a clue. If you want to live a longer, healthier life, it is essential to know your numbers so that you can take control of your health and make changes as needed. But we all know that getting labs is not an easy task. First, you have to see your doctor. Then they have to order the labs. Then you go to the lab and hope they can draw your blood without too much pain. And then wait for results. Once you have the results, you may not even know what they mean. What if there was a better way? SciFox Health has pioneered a novel approach to create the most comprehensive, most convenient, and least expensive at-home blood test on the market. They are the easiest, most affordable way to check your blood biomarkers. They give you the ability to test 17 critical blood biomarkers in a single at-home kit. It's easy to use and offered at an incredibly low price. It's clinically accurate, and you don't need a doctor's order to obtain it. If you want to decrease your risk of cardiovascular disease, there are several key biomarkers that can give you a picture of your cardiovascular and metabolic health. The SciFox Health Kit includes total cholesterol, triglycerides, HDL, LDL, ApoB, apolipoprotein A1, and hemoglobin A1C. ApoB is now being recognized as an important indicator of cardiovascular health, and most people have never had this blood test measured. SciFox Health reports are not just raw data. The team at SciFox created a unique scoring system called the Axes of Wellness that spans different health and lifestyle categories, such as inflammation, metabolic, and cardiovascular health. With this, they take the guesswork out of interpreting your results and empower you with actionable insights to improve your wellness. You can view your results in your secure dashboard, which includes personalized recommendations. It's very easy and convenient. Your kit is mailed directly to your home. Then you open your kit and simply follow the instructions. You supply just a few drops of blood and mail it back in a prepaid envelope. And incredibly, you get your results in a few days. It really is that simple. You don't need to drive anywhere or call the doctor's office repeatedly to get results. It's affordable and you have actionable data at your fingertips.
Before I completed my first Sifox health kit, I had never had my ApoB measured, and I was so glad to have this piece of data about my cardiovascular health. Sifox Health is the easiest, most affordable way to routinely check your blood biomarkers and stay on top of your health. I'm so excited to be working with Sifox Health. Visit sifoxhealth.com/yami to get 20% off to test your blood at home and begin working toward a healthier you. That's sifoxhealth.com/yami. Well, it's official. Back to school season has begun. Why does it always seem to sneak up on me? We are now in the whirlwind of drop-offs and pickups, sport practices, and parent volunteer hours. There is so much to do all the time. That's why I'm really glad we have ways to keep eating healthy even when the schedule is bursting at the seams. If you want to ensure that you will be able to put delicious and nutritious meals on the table during the busy school fall season, I highly recommend Green Chef. Green Chef is the number one meal kit for eating well, delivering pre-portioned and prepped quality whole foods with limited process ingredients. Green Chef sends organic, fresh produce and chef-designed recipes in every box for satisfying, nourishing, and convenient meals that make it easy to stick to a healthy living routine. You get to choose from 80-plus flavor-packed options that allow you to take back time in the kitchen with dinner ready in 30 minutes. Here's the best part. Green Chef delivers everything you need to make convenient, wholesome, and delicious meals directly to your doorstep. Each meal kit includes pre-measured ingredients, as well as some produce that comes already pre-chopped, as well as custom sauces that are pre-made in-house. They also provide the recipe cards, and the meals are very simple to make. It's a delicious, fresh, home-cooked meal without the hassle. Green Chef takes the stress out of cooking. The recipes are easy to follow and everything you need is included, so even less experienced cooks in your house can prepare a delicious home-cooked meal. I appreciate the variety of plant-based meals available. This week we had curry-spiced sweet potato wraps, mushroom artichoke and pesto flatbreads, and spicy peanut and veggie sesame rice bowls. Those were extremely delicious. The recipes are so yummy and approved by the whole family. I love that they include lots of veggies for a delicious and nutritious meal. The vegan meal kits are hearty, so you don't have to worry that you'll go hungry. And now you have the option to double your portion of protein or veggies, and you can swap to a plant-based protein like organic tofu or tempeh. We have loved using Green Chef in our household. If you want fresh, home-cooked, healthy meals to put on the table, look no further than Green Chef. And now, take your healthy routine further with 2 times the support. You get to select from Green Chef's healthiest menu ever and access thousands of top-rated gyms and fitness studios worldwide from ClassPass. For a limited time, new Green Chef subscribers will also receive 50 free credits to use at ClassPass, about a month's worth of membership. Go to greenchef.com/IamHumanClass for 50% off your first box plus 50 free credits with ClassPass. That's code IamHumanClass at greenchef.com/IamHumanClass to get 50% off your first box plus 50 free ClassPass credits. Green Chef, the number one meal kit for eating well. If you're obsessed with real-time data and want to know what's going on with your metabolism, you'll want to try Lumen. Lumen is the world's first handheld metabolic coach. It's a device that measures your metabolism through your breath. On the app, it tells you if you're burning fat or carbs and gives you tailored guidance to improve your nutrition, workouts, sleep, and even stress management. It can also track your cycle as well as the onset of menopause and adjust your recommendations to keep your metabolism healthy through hormonal shifts so you can keep up your energy and stave off cravings. All you have to do is breathe into your Lumen first thing in the morning and you'll know whether you're burning mostly fats or carbs. Then Lumen gives you a personalized nutrition plan for that day based on your measurements. Lumen will give you tips to keep you on top of your health game. Listen up. Metabolic health matters. Most chronic diseases that are preventable with diet and lifestyle habits are caused by dysfunctions in metabolism. When you have a healthy metabolism, you feel better and you perform better. You have improved sleep, healthy weight maintenance, and enough energy to do the activities that you love. I'm getting back on my routine after celebrating my birthday for a few weeks, and I'm using my Lumen to get back into my fasting regimen. I use my Lumen every morning upon waking, and it really helps me stay on track. The insights you get from Lumen can be very helpful for those trying to optimize their energy levels, sleep, or those using intermittent fasting to reach their health goals. So if you want to take the next step in improving your health, go to lumen.me/Dr. Yami to get 15% off your Lumen. That's lumen.me/DRYAMI for 15% off your purchase. Thank you, Lumen, for sponsoring this episode. Armoire makes getting dressed easy. With a clothing rental membership from Armoire, build the perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you have to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and select items from your dynamic, personalized closet. The styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. Then, when you're ready for new clothes, just swap them out for more new-to-you styles. Renting from Armoire is perfect for me because I love fashion. I get bored easily. I love to try new things with low commitment, and I'm also a minimalist who is budget conscious. Clothing rental just makes sense. It's so fun. You get to try new styles that you may not be brave enough to buy and keep forever, and your wardrobe stays fresh and updated. We live in a small old house with tiny closets that get cluttered easily, but I love clothes. I don't want to compromise. I want to look cute and feel great, and with clothing rental, it's a win-win. My first shipment of rental items arrived quickly, and all my items were neatly folded, clean, and ready to wear. The first item I tried on was a pair of overalls from Wild Fang, and I've already worn them 3 times because they're adorable and so soft and comfy. Today, I'm wearing a beautiful floral linen wrap dress from Yumi Kim, and I feel so feminine. It's really elevated my mood. I have 4 more items to try this week, including some cute corduroy wide leg ankle pants, a pair of super wide leg jeans, a sophisticated midi dress, and a puffy sleeve V-neck sweater. Getting dressed in the morning is exciting, and I feel great all day. There are so many reasons to try Armoire. First and foremost, you'll always have something new to wear without the hassle and closet clutter. It's affordable. They have many plans to choose from, depending on how often you'd like to swap out your outfits, but it could actually save you money in the long run. It's sustainable. You no longer have to feel bad about only wearing an outfit once, letting it sit in your closet for years until you finally donate it. It also feels good to support a company that is women-founded and women-led. And finally, Armoire can help you define your personal style. It gives you recommendations based on your body type and what you already like, but it also gives you the freedom to explore different styles you may not otherwise buy. If you've never tried something like this before but feel intrigued, I recommend that you give it a try. Right now, my listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off their first month. That's up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/Dr. Yami. That's armoire.style, armoire.style/DRYAMI to get up to 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today.
I think it's interesting because I think that there's a lot of people that want to help and they want to do the most that they can for whatever cause that they're passionate about. But I think that you're right in that a lot of us as humans, we do want that feel good factor from it, like something that is something that, you know, we grew up with or we're biased with. And so I think whenever we look at it in this big picture way, it does make a lot of sense. And I'm glad that in the book, you were able to point us to some websites and some organizations that can help us because they do that kind of research. So can you maybe mention a couple of those that we can use whenever we're thinking, okay, where are we going to donate our money to? Where are we going to donate our time to? How do we figure that out?
Yeah, absolutely, Dr. Yami. There are organizations that dedicate their lives to determining this. So one of those is called Animal Charity Evaluators. It was founded over 10 years ago with effective altruism in mind, using effective altruism principles to evaluate thousands of animal charities to figure out which ones are the most efficacious, which ones actually make the biggest difference. Because we learned from all form, like studying all types of different charities around America and around the world, that some are not just 5 or 10 or 100 times better, but sometimes some charities are thousands of times more effective than others. And so Animal Charity Evaluators has done that with animal charities, with animal nonprofit organizations. And they've looked at thousands of them. They use dozens of pieces of criteria to scrutinize them, evaluate them. I mentioned throughout the book all the things that they look for. The impact they make, the potential for, you know, future impact, their how they spend their money, how effective they are at raising money, how they utilize their resources, how happy their staff is, all these different things. And what they've determined is that some of these organizations, and some your listeners may not have even heard of, are some of the most impactful in the world, even if they don't have the popular name behind them that we're all familiar with. And that's very true in human cause charities as well. There's all these ones, you know, Make-A-Wish Foundation or Race for the Cure, there's some very, American Red Cross, whatever. There's some very popular ones that everybody knows, but it doesn't mean they're the best or that they use the resources most effectively or they make the biggest difference in the world. The same is in the animal charity world as well. So I'll tell you some. I don't need people to go buy the book just to learn these. I'll tell you. The Humane League, I've already mentioned, I believe, in this conversation, is one of the best. In fact, they've been a top animal charity through the Animal Charity Evaluators, top animal charity selection for 10 years running, I think, ever since this system was created. They've been a top animal charity every single year. Like I told you, they can spare an animal's life for as little as 33 cents. And that's because they have relationships with thousands of food companies, with thousands of farmers, through education programs, with politicians, with policymakers, with educators, with grassroots organizers and community organizers, because they work with small animals where like chickens, where it takes about 150 to 200 individual chicken lives to create the same edible meat as one cow, for example. So that's how they can spare so many more lives, because they focus on some of the smaller animals. Therefore, they reduce suffering collectively in more impactful ways that way. They're one of the best. And I encourage people to donate to them, contribute to them, support them, promote them. Even if you don't open up your wallet, share their website on your social media pages, in your newsletter, mention it to your friend on your birthday, ask people to maybe make a donation in your name on your birthday in lieu of gifts, all those things. Faunalytics, probably not on a lot of people's radar, but it should be. They are the biggest vegan research, animal rights research database library in the world, including studying the behavior of the 99%. You know, how do we reach non-vegans? I'm guessing right now, if we were to pause and ask your audience, why do you eat the way you eat? Why do you choose the foods that you choose? And why do you perhaps identify as plant-based or vegan or whatever, or, you know, plant curious, whatever? Many of your listeners right now would say, oh, for my health, for the animals and the planet, right? That is not at all what motivates the 99%. That's not even in their top 10. You know what's on their top 10? Taste, cost, convenience, culture, heritage, religion, economics, social pressure, peer pressure, food deserts, all types of things. You got to go way down the list. Preferences, habits, you know, these taste bud preferences I developed ever since I started eating bacon. All down, nowhere do we get any sort of empathy or compassion or worry about animals' health of the environment. So why do we keep talking about those talking points when the 99% is not interested? That doesn't guide their decision-making. That's something that Faunalytics is very good at exposing and sharing with people. And that's, again, it gets our bias out of the way, because we think, oh yeah, everybody, if we just have the best stats, the best data, the best arguments, if I could beat you, Dr. Yami, in a debate, then I would win everybody over. No, it's not the way it works. And so Faunalytics, absolutely go support them. You know, one that I donate to on a monthly basis, it's in the conclusion of my book too, so spoiler alert, Dharma Voices for Animals. I'm guessing 90% of people listening have never heard of them. But they are an animal charity evaluators, like top, they didn't win like the top award, but they're like one of the honorable mentions or second tier, one of the best animal charities. Why? Because they are the world's only international Buddhist animal rights organization that works in Vietnam, Thailand, and Sri Lanka. Primarily, they also, I think, work in Laos and Cambodia and that whole general Malaysia, that whole region, but primarily in Sri Lanka, Vietnam, and Thailand, where the dollar stretches so far, where they do a lot of fundraising here in the U.S. and they do all their meaningful work, but then they're able to take those resources out to those countries. And I gave a powerful example. I don't know if you caught this part. It was only, I mean, just a few, two sentences maybe in the book. But I wrote about the Sri Lankan monk because of his connection with parliament in his country and being well-respected, well-connected, and because he's a compassionate vegan who, at the time I talked to him in a FaceTime interview, he was spaying and neutering, you know, dogs on the streets in Sri Lanka. But he basically, by himself, through standing up and speaking up and having authority in his country, prevented 100,000 primates from being deported to China to be used in animal testing laboratories. That's the power of understanding what I call our strong V, which is a big foundation of the book. That's our skills, our talents, our resources, our other strengths, our network, our generosity, and our volunteering. Here's a guy who used his network, his resources, his talents, and prevented 100,000 of our closest relatives, primates, from being sent off to horrific conditions in animal experimentation laboratories. But that may not be an organization you'd ever heard of or that your listeners had ever heard of. I can tell you, humbly, I had never heard of them until I started learning about animal charity evaluators and looked at their recommended charities. And then I actually met Bob Isaacson, who's their president. I've met him multiple times now at animal rights conferences in different parts of the country. And I've come to really respect the work they do. And there's also, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the Good Food Institute, Bruce Friedrich's organization. It's a $50 million annual budget organization that is focusing on the future of food, getting animals out of the food system. How do we do that? Well, they work with cultivated meat, which is animal cells, rather than, you know, growing meat from animal cells rather than from slaughtering animals. They work with 1,400 different alternative protein companies. They work with multiple foreign governments who are advancing practices in either precision fermentation, which is basically creating just almost identical animal protein out of fermented plants in these big machines. I also interviewed Paul Shapiro. Sorry, Paul. I reference Paul all the time in all my talks and his name escaped me for a moment. Paul Shapiro from the Better Meat Company. I interviewed him for the book, one of the most profound interviews in the entire book. And he does the same thing. Precision fermentation. He's prevented the need for 500,000 chickens to be used because of the products that he's produced already in the early stages of his company. And so Good Food Institute is another one absolutely worth donating to, contributing to, supporting. You might think, yeah, but they already work with tens of millions of dollars. But they're also one of the most important most important organizations in the history or in the future, you know, for our world as far as getting animals out of the food system. They're just one of the most profound and most powerful with that. And you can probably tell these are all very different organizations. One I'm talking is about alternative protein and the future of getting animals out of the food system and, you know, getting rid of industrialized factory farming by using other methods. One was about international organization that mostly works in Southeast Asia. Another one was about a research library. And another one was focused on chickens, the animal that's consumed the most in America outside of fish. And then there's many others. Mercy for Animals is another one. And there's plenty of others working all throughout the world that are absolutely worth supporting, promoting, contributing to, volunteering with, amplifying, spreading the word about. And so that's where we can spend a lot of our time and resources if we want to get the most bang for our buck. And there's, I don't want to go on too long, but there's also like, there's nuances within that too. There's certain times where your donation is being matched, doubled or tripled by wealthy donors. These are things like Giving Tuesday, which is, you know, at right after Black Friday. It's at the end of the year. It's at certain times during the year. There's usually two or three times during the year where donations are matched or even tripled when you contribute to these significant animal charity organizations. That means if you save up $1,000 all year, now you have $2,000 to $3,000 you can donate. Or if you save up $5,000, you're up to $15,000. And imagine the difference you can make. And the reason that's important, and this will be the last thing I say on this, it's fundamentally important to understand what is unequivocally true, is that it is our contributions that are more impactful than our personal actions. Case in point, the average vegan, the typical vegan, is going to spare about 365 animal lives per year. But by donating just a fraction of your annual income to the most impactful animal charities in the world, you can spare 10 to 15,000 animal lives per year just through those donations alone. Because they already have the systems in place, the relationships built, the education tools, they know how to create change and get policy changes and put pressure on restaurants and food suppliers and retail stores and grocery stores to change their offerings and impact supply and demand. So it's always our contributions that are more impactful than our actions, which we see in anything from disaster relief. I mean, I can't hop on a plane and go fly across the world and go, hey, I'm here to help with no medical training. I'd be getting in the way. I have no idea what I'm doing. But instead of paying thousands of dollars for flight and hotel and lodging, luggage and food and pet sitting, I can just send some money to the people who are fully equipped and knowledgeable to go save lives. That's the same in any kind of charity. Our contributions are one of the most impactful things we can possibly do. Look what's happening right now, literally as we speak. In politics, it's you know, donations and campaign fundraising and all that, because they know that equals more than one vote. We all get one vote, but through whether we like it or not, influence of media and advertising and all that, fundraising leads to more votes than our individual vote. So that's not to discourage people from being, you know, proactive and taking action yourself. I have a whole section in the book about that, things that you can do, things that I can do, things that we can do as individuals. But we have to step back outside of our personal bias and say, you know what? By donating to the best of the best organizations in the world, I can do so much more for animals, and I've got to do more of that.
Yeah. And I'm so glad that you were able to give us a direction in that, because I think for a lot of us, if we haven't had time to sit down and research and try to figure that out on our own, now we can look at these organizations that have done that for us. And Robert has listed some of the top ones for us too. So I appreciate that, because you're right. Most of the ones that were listed at the top, I had never heard of before. So I was like, okay, this means I really need to be doing my research. And one of the things my husband and I usually do is we usually do wait until the end of the year to give our contributions so that we can contribute to those matching campaigns. Cause that's something my husband is a very like analytical, logical person. He's like, it'll make more of an impact if you wait and donate it at that time. So we just save up our donation money and then sit down at the end of the year and decide, okay, we're going to allocate to this and this and this. And that helps a lot. One of the things that you talk about in your book also, though, is leading by example. So talk about the power of leading by example and how can we lead by example?
Yeah, absolutely. I believe, and I think we recognize this in sports and music and art and culture, that we are attracted to those who we aspire to be like. I mean, we grew up with all those commercials, I want to be like Mike, right? Everybody wanted to be like Michael Jordan, myself included. We couldn't get enough of it, right? Or now, people just can't wait to be like Beyonce or Taylor Swift or whatever. In this kind of pop culture, we have these role models, these idols, these aspirational people. But this can be done on smaller scales as well. How often, I mean, do you see people with these physical transformations that inspire people all over the internet? I mean, Forks Over Knives is quite well known for that. They've inspired, it seems like, millions of people at this point to change their dietary eating habits and change their lifestyle for the better. And they have these amazing transformations, getting off medications and losing weight and having more energy and increasing longevity and all these types of things. And the same goes with the way that I have used and leveraged my fitness background to reduce animal suffering. You want to talk about your concerns about protein intake and building muscle and strength and all that? Well, then let me show you. Let me lead by example. Let me open up this door for you. Let me write these books or film this documentary or become a champion bodybuilder. Let me show you. You don't have to be a bodybuilder. You don't have to be an athlete. You don't have to be a chef. You don't have to be an author. But if you can find a way to lead by example, even if it's just through your compassion, just being a thoughtful and caring person, I mean, that's what we love about many people, you know, especially many religious leaders over the years, or people fighting for peace, you know, Gandhi or Mother Teresa or whoever you want to mention. There's all these different people we've looked up to because they've, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., whomever, they practice nonviolence, they practice peace, they embrace it, they speak about it, they embody it. That has revolutionized societies and cultures. And you can do it through physical body transformation. You can do it through academia. You can do it through art and music and all these other platforms. You can do it through a social media presence. You can do it through creating beautiful and delicious food and introducing that to people who said, you know, I didn't know that was possible. I didn't know it was possible to consume satiating, nourishing, tasty food that didn't have animal protein in it. I just didn't know that was available. And so leading by example is all those things, but it's also being a leader in your community, being a listener, being supportive, offering a helping hand, sharing. I wrote an entire section about the Vegan Strong Method, which is getting plant-based products of all types, plant-based foods, products, sports nutrition, whatever you want to call it. I just use the word product as an umbrella, but getting plant-based products into the hands, homes, and mouths of as many omnivores as possible. And that can be through your church group, through your community, through your sports league, through your group of friends, through your family, through your network, through your colleagues, your work environment. Leading by example could be a plant-based by default approach. I wrote an entire little section on that in the book too, where if you're in charge of catering, of food selection, of banquet, of organizing, of whatever it is, you're involved in the process of determining what food is available at a given event, a plant-based by default approach, which is happening in New York City public hospitals, in major universities around the world. And even as I wrote about in the book, even travel companies like that boating tour company in Hawaii that does and that provides entirely plant-based meals. That's all they offer to a 99% mainstream omnivorous audience. And people are fine with it. They're totally embrace it. So leading by example is many things, but I think it starts with authenticity and optimism and positivity and aspirational character traits that other people aspire toward and gratitude. I can't go a day without typing the word gratitude or grateful dozens of times, every email with gratitude, you know, or I'm grateful or so appreciative. That was me all day as I'm signing books and shipping them out for people who order signed copies. Everything starts with gratitude and some sort of humility for the incredible privilege that we have to be in a position of power and luxury and freedom and choice that we have here in the Western world in many aspects of our lives. And I think we acknowledge that, we embrace that, and have some sort of moral responsibility. At least that's how I feel as a very privileged individual. I feel moral responsibility to use my strengths to make others' lives better, and others extends to animals too.
Yeah, I think that's so well said. And I feel like the power of example in some ways is immeasurable because I've been vegan now for 13 years. And I feel like it's created a ripple effect in my friends and family, people that I've met, classes that I've taught, my patients. And, you know, it's not like everybody that's ever met me has become plant-based, but a lot of people have reduced their consumption of animals. And there are some people that have gone fully plant-based. So I know you talked about earlier that just being vegan, you can only save a certain amount of animals per year just by not eating animals, right? But just think about whenever you have that positive effect on others and it creates that ripple effect, because then they also influence others and they influence others. And I know that we're not going to get to a vegan world anytime soon, but every little bit of positivity that we can spread in this way of life, in this way of eating, I think can go a long way.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And Dr. Yami, one quick example is my older sister. She lives a very quiet vegan lifestyle, has a vegan partner, a vegan daughter. She's a PhD research scientist in soil microbiology at Washington State University. So, you know, she spares a few hundred animal lives per year, but she inspired me, right? She inspired someone who would go on to write books that would become New York Times bestseller and translate into 9 languages worldwide and become this world's most recognized vegan bodybuilder for a decade. Then I would go on to inspire all these people like Matt Frazier from No Meat Athlete, and even in the early days, inspire people like Rich Roll, who went on to have massive careers, and Nimai Delgado and Natalie Matthews and all that. That's the power of example. My sister created an example that I give credit to her anytime I can in my books, in my talks or whatever. She's not looking for it. She's not seeking it. She lives a quiet life. She's still as vegan as ever, but it's just not part of her public persona and wearing it on her sleeve like her younger brother, who is louder and more enthusiastic. And same with me. I have my presence online or whatever, but I've been able to inspire people who have been way more successful than me at growing, amassing millions of followers and people who've been financially way more successful than me and able to contribute so much more because of that. So we are all leading by example in ways that we have no idea. Like you said, it's immeasurable. We don't know how to connect those dots because they're so far reaching and they can be so deeply impactful that they're able to inspire change in those who go on to then inspire millions of others. It's this big ripple effect. It's this big chain reaction. And I'm just fortunate to be part of it and to, you know, contribute whatever I can contribute to this movement that means so much to me. And I'm grateful for all those who are on this journey with me and who have inspired me and who I've been fortunate enough to inspire through my work.
Well, you've given us so much to think over and really evaluate in our lives, especially for those of us that do want to make the biggest impact. So thank you so much for sharing all that you've had, that you have shared on this episode. Now, for the listeners, there's so much more in his book that we didn't even scratch the surface on. His Strong V method, he talks about all of that. And one of the things that I really like too is how you talk about the different types of activism that we can do and which ones actually are the most impactful and which ones actually could be harmful to the movement. So I think that's very important for people to learn. So you definitely have to pick up a copy of this book if you're really interested in learning more about it, because he has a lot in there. But we are running out of time. So let's go to the wrap-up questions. What do you wish more people knew?
I wish more people knew that it was okay to be their authentic selves and to live in alignment with their inner compassion and to live and let live and really believe it and really embrace it and allow others around us through our actions to live and let live too. And I think if we believe that about ourselves and believed in that, we'd have a lot more peace and compassion throughout the world.
I love that. That's profound. How do you define success in this lifetime?
I think success is very difficult to define. I feel like I'm fortunate enough to have tasted some of it, but also a lot of failure and disappointment and frustration. I guess I go back to success being the pursuit of the most elusive thing in our lives, which is true happiness. True. Absolutely unobjected, just real, pure happiness and joy and gratitude and fulfillment. And I think at the end of the day, that's where we find success, not in the material things, not in the even in the achievements, because that fades away and becomes a memory and it leaves us striving for more and more and more. Success is the unobstructed happiness. It's just so hard to achieve it. And that's my wish, for as many humans and non-human animals as possible to achieve that level of success, of pure happiness, contentment, and joy. And I implore people to keep chasing it.
That's so beautiful. Is there a goal or a dream that has evaded you thus far? Something that you have left on your bucket list that you'd be willing to share with us?
Yeah. Again, I'm so lucky that I did achieve some, like becoming a New York Times bestseller. I set that goal decades ago and somehow made it. Took me 33 years or so, but I got there. If I'm objective and I guess semi-selfish, I would say that a level of financial freedom eludes me and has eluded me for a long time. And the reason why that has been frustrating or discouraging for me is because I know the value of how to reallocate those kind of funds to reduce suffering in the world. I feel like I have a better understanding of that than most. I wrote a whole book on it. And that is an ongoing process. I always thought I could make a living as a writer if I just wrote enough books and sold enough copies and got enough speaking engagements. But I've been publishing books for 15 years and writing way before that too. And that still eludes me, that full professional writing career without having to do all the side jobs, all the other stuff, all the complementary and supplementary work. And I would like to achieve that someday for myself, for my family, and for the ways that I know I could contribute in very meaningful ways that would absolutely change the world for those around me. Whether it's, you know, the poor, struggling person in another part of the world, perhaps, or animals who are suffering on a large scale. And that's something perhaps down the road or our next conversation, I'll be further along. And that's been an ongoing struggle, but I'm still working toward it every day and trying to get there because I know how much it would mean to those that I believe that I could help with those resources.
Thanks for sharing that. I feel like there's probably a lot of people that can identify with you on that, especially for those of us that are more service-oriented humans that, you know, we're out there trying to help as many as we can. I think there must be some like vows of poverty somewhere back in past lives or something that we said, but you know, I think that can definitely happen. What does it mean to be human?
I'm flooded with all kinds of things. I mean, words that come to mind are things like privilege, responsibility, awareness, unbelievable gratitude, you know, things like that. But the single word that comes to mind, but it's not unique to humans, is to feel. I mean, to really feel experiences, sensations, senses, to be able to think critically, to have a broad range of emotions, to have the freedom to express those emotions, which, you know, unfortunately, a lot of other non-human animals can't. They can't express themselves in ways that we understand. So I think being human is unique. There's only 8 billion of us or so. But I think it also comes with a tremendous amount of responsibility and inherited privilege that other species don't have. And I think we need to acknowledge that, appreciate that, and never forget it.
Yeah. And I love how you brought up responsibility too, because I think that we do have a big responsibility because we have been given these gifts and this ability to make choices and to reason and, you know, to use science and data to make decisions. So hopefully we'll get to the point in our humanity sometime where we use this data and we're like, eating animals makes zero sense. Zero sense. You know, why are we doing this? So I have faith that we'll eventually get there. But you're right. I think that we do have a lot of responsibility when it comes to being human. Well, Robert, this has been a fantastic conversation. I appreciate you so much, all the work that you've put into, all the dedication that you've had since 15 years old, and you just continue putting in the time and the effort to help animals, to spread the message to other humans. So thank you so much for everything that you do. I know that my listeners want to be able to get in touch with you if they haven't already. So where can we connect with you? Where can we buy your books? What products and services do you offer?
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Yami. I appreciate the opportunity today. I know it's been a long time coming. So thank you so much for having me. I'm grateful for that. You know, Robert Cheek with an E on the end. You can find me online, pretty much every platform that's out there. And I also run veganbodybuilding.com, which I've done for more than 2 decades now. I also have impactfulvegan.com, where if you want to determine if this book is right for you, you can go download an entirely free chapter plus the introduction, a 31-page PDF, totally for free. It's all yours. Get it, save it to your phone, save it to your computer, read it when you like and see if that's for you. And also realize that the proceeds from the Impactful Vegan are going to 5 of the top animal charities in the world, including one that provides a vegan meal to hungry children throughout the world to the tune of 1 million vegan meals every single day. That's Food Yoga International, formerly known as Food for Life Global. They've been doing that for over 40 years, feeding over 8 billion vegan meals to people, to children in 65 developing countries. And so I would love your support. You can find my book. It's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, bookshop.org, independent bookstores, pretty much everywhere. It's hardcover. It's beautiful, bright orange cover with a chicken on the cover, and endorsed by wonderful people like Tabitha Brown and Rich Roll and Dan Buettner and Kathy Freston and Plant-Based News and many of the incredible people in our movement. And I would be grateful for your support. And I hope that you'll love the book as much as I enjoyed writing it and sharing it with the world, and would kindly leave an honest review online. That would be greatly appreciated, because we really need to get this message out there to as many people as possible. And collectively, we can make a difference. So thank you again. And find me online, say hi anytime. And thanks for tuning in today. And Dr. Yami, appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you so much, Robert, for everything that you do. And I hope that you have a very plantastic day.
Thank you. You too. I'm Robert Cheek, and I am human.
Thank you for listening to another episode of I Am Human. I would be so honored if you subscribe to the podcast so that you never miss an episode. We love our listeners and take your feedback seriously. If you have questions or constructive feedback, you can email us at podcast@dryami.com. That's podcast@dryami.com. I am your host, Dr. Yami Cazorla Lancaster. I Am Human is produced by myself and Alejandra Parra. Graphics designed by Alejandra Parra. Music by Angela Sof with Glowbox Productions, and edited by the Castos production team. Remember, human, you are here for a reason. Have fun, explore, and live your life to the fullest.